1 Samuel chapter 17 is where we're picking up. And again, it's funny because we come upon this chapter, and this is very familiar. In fact, if you've been to Sunday school at all as a kid, you probably hit this one at least once, because it's the story of David and Goliath. And, you know, the tendency is to think, oh, what a great kid's story. I love this story. I've colored in the sheets many times, the little coloring sheet. I've seen the Veggie Tales with the big pickle, and I know all about this story. Yet, it's not a kid's story. This is an adult story, and it's not a story that we should take lightly because there's a lot of stuff in it. 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 11, Paul, in talking about what happened to the Israelites in that context when they were wandering in the desert and under the cloud and going through the Red Sea and all that. But it applies to all of the Old Testament. He says, now all these things happen unto them for examples, and they are written for our admonition, upon whom the ends of the world are come. They did happen. This is a real event that did happen to the king David when he was still a boy or a young guy. And yet, it's also there for our admonition. So let's take a look at this and see what the Lord has. Verse 1 of 1 Samuel 17. Now the Philistines gathered together their armies to battle, and were gathered together at Shoco, which belongeth to Judah, and pitched between Shoco and Azekah in Ephes-Naaman. And Saul and the men of Israel were gathered together, and pitched by the valley of Elah, and set the battle in array against the Philistines. And the Philistines stood on a mountain on one side, and Israel stood on a mountain on the other side, and there was a valley between them. The Philistines are the perpetual, but they are certainly the largest nemesis of Israel during this time. They come out to battle against the Israelites. It is worth noting, I like to look up the names sometimes of what the various places mean. Sometimes they have meaning. The one, Ephes-Naaman, it means the edge or the boundary of blood. And as we go through this, remember, because, look, we're going through 1 Samuel 17 that has to deal with a giant, because all of us are going to go through giants. We're going to have to face giants in our life. There are going to be situations that are going to be so enormously overwhelming that we can't possibly deal with them. And the first thing to take note of is that there is, if you're a believer, a boundary or the edge of blood that can never go past. There is a hedge of protection that the Lord has placed in us. And that's where the camp is set up. And it seems, we don't know how big these armies are. In chapter 15, a couple chapters ago, when Saul got an army together, there were 215,000 men. So it's a good size army. And the way they aligned themselves is there was a mountain on one side, mountain on the other side, valley in between. And the two armies were kind of facing each other, separated by this valley, kind of a brook running down through the middle of it. And they face each other. And it says in verse 4, there went out a champion out of the camp of the Philistines named Goliath of Gath, whose height was 6 cubits and a span. 6 cubits and a span. A cubit, biblically, and there is some discrepancy on exactly how big a cubit is, partially because the standard measurement was from the tip of a man's index finger to the tip of his elbow, which, depending on the man, can vary significantly. If you're Al, it could be really short. If you're somebody with longer arms, it could be long. But the standard rule of thumb is it's somewhere around a foot and a half, maybe a little more, a little less, which makes Goliath stand somewhere between 9.5 and 10 feet tall. And 9.5 and 10 feet tall. It's tough to even visualize that. I don't know how many of you guys, we live up in Maine. It's a ways to go to get to any professional teams. But if you've ever been to a professional basketball game where you've seen some truly large men, Shaquille O'Neal, he's 7'1", 330 pounds. 7'1", 330 pounds. Now, it's hard to even imagine what that's like. I mean, I'm 6'1", 220 after a couple of days of dieting. So we'll say, you know, six. So he's a foot taller than me and 110 pounds bigger than me. My son, Elijah, is probably, 4 feet or so? So the difference between Shaquille O'Neal, who is huge, and Elijah is about the difference between Goliath and Shaquille O'Neal. This is not a beanpole guy. This is a huge man. If you do the math proportionally and go up, he probably weighs somewhere between 6, 7, 750 pounds. He's monstrous. He's enormous. He's huge. We know in Numbers chapter 13, when they first came, the Israelites, to the border of the land, in verse 32, the 12 spies went in. Joshua and Caleb said, "Let us add them." The other 10, it says, brought up an evil report. It says in Numbers 13, 32, "And they brought up an evil report of the land which they had searched unto the children of Israel, saying, The land through which we have gone to search it is a land that eateth up the inhabitants thereof, and all the people that we saw in it are men of a great stature. And there we saw giants, the sons of Anak, which come of the giants, and we were in our own sight as grasshoppers, and so we were in their sight." We were puny. In Joshua chapter 11, after Joshua takes the Israelites into the land and starts cleaning out the inhabitants, it says this, "And at that time came Joshua, and he cut off the Anakims," they're the descendants of Anak, these giants, "from the mountains, from Hebron and Debir and from Anab and from all the mountains of Judah and from all the mountains of Israel. Joshua destroyed them utterly with their cities. There was none of the Anakims left in the land and the children of Israel, only in Gaza and in Gath and in Ashdod there remained." So apparently there are still some giants left. They're not... I went to an NBA game and I saw Manute Bol once, and he was 7'7". I think he was 7'6 or 7'7". And he probably, if he weighed 200 pounds, I would have been surprised. He was thin as a rail. His elbows and his knees were the biggest parts of his body. It was not a guy like this. This is a really big, monstrous guy. It gives some definition of what he's carrying. It says he had a helmet of brass upon his head, and he was armed with a coat of mail, and the weight of the coat was 5,000 shekels of brass. That's about 200 pounds. So just the armor he was lugging around was 200 pounds. He's wearing for clothes a little less than me. I'm on his back. That's just what he wears for clothing when he fights, you know. So he's a big enough guy that a 200-pound guy on his back doesn't slow him down. It's his fighting weight stuff, you know. I mean, he's a big guy. It says he had greaves of brass upon his legs. He had these brass shin guard things, because you got to figure everybody's going to fight him. Where are they going to hit him? In the shins. That's what he's used to. Nobody's even reaching up high enough to get at his head, so he's got to protect his legs. And a target of brass between his soldiers. Literally, it's a dart or some kind of a stabbing, throwing thing. More than likely, he had a thing where his sword just, you know, was scabbarded or hooked on behind his thing, so he could be like He-Man and, you know, pull out the sword from his back. It said, "The staff of his spear was like a weaver's beam, and his spear's head weighed 600 shekels of iron, and one bearing a shield would be formed." 600 shekels of iron is about 25 pounds. A shot put. Any of you guys who've ever played, my father used to throw the shot put when he was in college. We had a couple of them around the house in his shop. A shot put's about 16 pounds. Any of you who ever tried to heave one of those things or hold it, it's heavy. Try putting one of those on the end of a long stick that's about that big around. I mean, if the head is about 25 pounds, the spear is probably, shaft has got to be about 25 pounds to balance it off. I was listening to Joe Foshan. He said, picture taking a long stick and putting a frozen turkey on the end and then being able to, you know, fight and actually throw that accurately. I mean, if you got hit with this guy's spear, it would, forget about the impact from a 45. A 50-pound projectile taking you in the chest would just blow you over and rip you up. This guy, to be able to wield a spear that big, he's hugely strong. He's enormous. And he came out, and it says in verse 8, "And he stood and cried unto the armies of Israel and said unto them, Why are you come out to set your battle in array? Am I not a Philistine, and you servants to Saul? Choose you a man for you, and let him come down to me." He comes out, and of course he's magnificent, and he's all shiny in armor, and he comes, he's got some guy carrying a shield, which you know is as big as the guy who's carrying it, comes out into the middle in front of all the armies, and he yells out and says, "Hey, I'm a Philistine, you choose somebody to come out." Now, we know from a previous chapter, the biggest guy, head and shoulders above everybody else in the camp of Israel, was Saul. So he's probably a good 7 feet tall. If you guys send somebody big, he's the one to go. But you'll notice we don't hear of Saul on the battlefield there. Apparently, he's not coming out to kill this giant. So Goliath comes out, and he says, "We don't need to do this. I'll tell you what. You just send somebody out to fight me. Give me a man from Israel. You come fight me, and we'll work this thing out mano a mano." It says, if he be able to fight with me, in verse 9, and to kill me, then we will be your servants. But if I prevail against him and kill him, then shall you be our servants and serve us. And the Philistine said, I defy the armies of Israel this day. Give me a man that we may fight together. And the implication is, isn't there even a man among you? 200,000 Israelites. Gee, you got a man that's willing to come out and fight against me? It's funny, really, when you think about it, because there's some types in this as well. Besides the story of David and Goliath, we know that David is a type of Christ. Here we're going to see David come. David's going to fight the giant. He's going to overcome the giant against what seems to be overwhelming odds, but he's going to do it under the power of the Spirit of the Lord. He's going to win for himself a bride out of this. I mean, there is a type of Christ in there. And yet, here is Goliath coming out all proud, like, isn't there even a man who can deal with me? Look at me, I am like the picture of manhood. Isn't there, it's got WWF written all over it. He's getting out there. Isn't there even a man here? And yet, like, that's some big thing. Like, I am like the prototypical man. And yet, when you look at Christ, here we have the creator of the universe humbling himself and being able to take on the lowly form of a man. When Satan comes as a superior life form, you know, saying and tempting him, Jesus' answer is, you know, since you're the Son of God, why don't you turn these stones into bread? His answer was, man does not live by bread alone. And Jesus fought him as a man. And on one hand, it's almost like the epitome of evolution for Goliath. I'm a man. Isn't there a man? And for Jesus, it's like, no, I'm just a man. I'm just the Son of Man. I'm just humble. And this guy is out there, and he is freaking out the army. Now, this is before the days of Samuel Colt, when all men were made equal through, you know, superior weaponry. Any killing that was done by and large on the battlefield here was done hand to hand. And he had a tremendous advantage through his size and his weaponry and his armor. Give me a man that we may fight together. And when Saul and all Israel heard the words of the Philistine, they were dismayed and greatly afraid. You know, chapter 14, he was on fire for God, and he got the men together, and he went and he fought with the Philistines and had this great victory. Chapter 16, because of his disobedience, God's spirit was lifted off of him, and with the spirit went the courage, and now all of a sudden he's looking at it from a man's perspective, and he's just as scared as everybody else. And it is so sad when you think about it, that this is the army of Israel. Israel is the nation that God has put his name on, the one that he has said are his people. And they have such a history of God fighting on their behalf. And now you've got a collection of it, probably at least a couple hundred thousand of them. And there isn't one who trusts him enough to stand up in front of this giant. Every one of them looks at that, and they look at this overwhelming thing, and they think, I have no chance. We don't have a chance. What are we going to do? But there was one person. It says, now David, in verse 12, was the son of that Ephrathite of Bethlehem, Judah, whose name was Jesse. And he had 8 sons, and the man went among men for an old man in the days of Saul. Jesse's an old dude. And the 3 eldest sons of Jesse went and followed Saul to the battle. And the names of his 3 sons that went to the battle were Eliab the firstborn, and next to him Abinadab, and the 3rd Shammah. And David was the youngest, and the 3 eldest followed Saul. But David went and returned from Saul to feed his father's sheep at Bethlehem. Now, we had read in the last chapter how Saul was being vexed by an evil spirit, and the only way he could get peace was to get somebody to play a musical instrument, and David was brought in for that. But apparently it was like a temporary thing, or it was a one-off thing. Like, whenever he was grieved, yeah, go find David, we'll have him play. But he wasn't a fixture in the court yet, and he came and went. And so when the battle came and Saul goes off, his older brothers go off to fight, David goes home. And you see his start even in this. He is a part-time courtier, but he's a full-time shepherd. You know, Samuel had dumped oil on his head and said, you're going to be the next king of Israel. But he doesn't go home to dad and say, watch the sheep. Perhaps you didn't notice the oil still in my hair. I am the next king of Israel. I don't do sheep duty anymore. I have other duties now that I do. I do kingly duties. I don't do sheep duties. That's for one of the other lesser brothers who were rejected. Now, he doesn't do any of that. David, again, and remember this, as you see all the stuff he does, remember, David is a man after God's own heart. David is a humble man. David is a man who does what needs to be done, and his dad needs somebody to watch the sheep. He's not above going to watch the sheep again. And the Philistines drew near morning and evening and presented himself. The Philistine presented himself. This is Goliath. 40 days, morning and evening. You know, as you look through some of the different people who were plagued throughout the Bible, it says 40 days. 40 is kind of a number of testing and judgment. It rained for 40 days on Noah. Moses was on the backside of the desert for 40 years. Jesus was tempted in the wilderness for 40 days. He fasted. 40 is kind of the number of testing. And it's interesting to see that it is morning and evening. You know how that is when you're going through stuff and you wake up and like the first thing on your mind as soon as you wake up is that thing that just dominates your thoughts, that it's just your problem and it's right in your face. And it's right there as soon as you wake up and it's like you're laying in bed and you come into consciousness and then you remember the problem. And it's like somebody sits in your chest before you even get out of the bed. You just sink down in there and you want to pull a cover over your head because it hits you first thing in the morning. And you go in all day. You just got this thing in the back of your mind. And you're trying to go to sleep at night and you're looking at the ceiling. And all you can think about is this thing that is just your problem. It's the one thing that's dominating your life over and over. Well, this thing for them was Goliath, and he came out and ran his mouth every morning. So it was the first thing they saw, and every night it was the last thing they heard, was this huge man getting in their face and saying, "You bunch of wussies, isn't there even a man in Israel who can fight?" When you read of Samson, you remember when Delilah tempted him. She did it. It says she pressed him daily with her words. It was just a daily grinding. And finally he gave in because of her much hammering him over his secret. Well, this Philistine is hammering them morning and night, the whole army for 40 days. And they don't dare do anything because the first guy to leave the ranks is going to have to face Goliath. And none of them can beat him. None of them dare. Now in the midst of this, verse 17, "And Jesse said unto David his son, Take now for thy brethren an ephah of this parched corn, and these 10 loaves, and run to the camp of thy brethren, and carry these 10 cheeses unto the captain of their 1,000, and look upon how thy brethren fare, and take their pledge." I mean, they're fighting in country. This is not like, you know, well, just run off to Iraq and see how the troops are doing. I mean, they're fighting nearby. So Jesse says, look, the boys are there in the army with Saul. Take some food to them. Here's a little cheese. Run this up and find out where they are. It says, "Now Saul and they and all the men of Israel were in the valley of Elah fighting with the Philistines," although at this point the fighting is pretty much consisted of Goliath shouting and them hoping that they don't get singled out and killed. "And David rose up early in the morning and left the sheep with a keeper and took and went as Jesse commanded him. And he came to the trench as the host was going forth into the fight and shouted for the battle." Now, we know from when the congregation was divided back in Deuteronomy, where it said how they would align for battle, and Judah was always first. They were the ones to lead the troops into battle, and David is from the tribe of Judah, so he knew where they would be, towards the front. So he goes to the front to see his brothers, and as he's going and the shouting is going on, it says, "For Israel and the Philistines had put the battle in array, army against army. And David left his carriage in the hand of the keeper of the carriage and ran into the army and came and saluted his brethren. And as he talked with him, behold, there came up the champion, the Philistine of Gath, Goliath by name, out of the armies of the Philistine, and spake according to the same words, and David heard them. And all the men of Israel, when they saw the man, fled from him and were sore afraid." All the men. How sad. 200,000 men scared of one guy. He's a big guy. "And the men of Israel said, Have you seen this man that has come up? Surely to defy Israel has he come up. And it shall be, the man that killeth him, the king will enrich him with great riches and will give him his daughter and make his father's house free in Israel." You know, we see David as he gets ready to do this thing. He's going to run into several obstacles that we run into as we face whatever the thing is going to be. The first one is he's going to come in amongst these faithless brethren and they're going to immediately point out the problem. "Have you seen this man?" They're gonna present to him the problem like it's this unbeatable thing. "Have you seen this man? It's there's no way we can defeat him." And back in Deuteronomy chapter 20, when the Lord was instructing them about how they go out to battle, the instruction was, don't be afraid. In fact, after they say set up the armies, they say, if there's anybody who just, you know, got a wife, go home to her. Don't worry about it. And the last instruction was, what man is there that is fearful and faint-hearted? If there's anybody even in the army, just let him go and return to his house, lest his brethren's heart faint as well as his heart. The rule from God was, when you're going to fight, I'm going to fight. So I if there's anybody there who just married somebody, just planted a vineyard, just built a house, you're afraid you're not going to miss out on that because you're dying, but just go home. We can work without you. In fact, if there's anybody even in all of the army that's afraid, you just go home and we'll work without you, because God's going to fight anyways. And if you're there and you're scared, you're just going to discourage your brethren. And what's the first thing David deals with? 200,000 people who are afraid and discouraging him from this thing. He walks onto the battlefield, and all they can say is, have you seen this man? Have you seen this man? And then look what they say happens to the person who kills him. It's gotten to the point where Saul can't get anybody to fight this guy. Saul won't do it. And so he's throwing out rewards. And this is all he has. He is a king. He doesn't know the Lord. It should be, and we're going to see the reason why David even takes this up is because the Lord is being insulted by this Philistine. And all Saul can do is offer some reward. Well, I'll give you great riches. I'll give you my daughter, which we're going to find is no great prize. In fact, that should be one of the cons in the whole equation. Well, I get the money, but there is the daughter, you know, because she's not a great thing. You'll see. And then it says his father's house will be free in Israel. It's tax-free. Your family tax-free for the rest of perpetuity, if you can beat this guy. Because that's all Saul's got. He's turned from being a godly king to being a carnal king, and all he has to offer is what this world prizes. And that's what he's trying to entice people into, a spiritual battle for earthly reward. And that's guaranteed failure. And look what David says. And David spake to the men that stood by him, saying, what shall be done to the man that killeth this Philistine and taketh away the reproach from Israel? Who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God? It's almost as if David is saying, the reward? What's going to be done for him if he does this thing and takes the reproach off of Israel and somebody who's defying God? It's like David saying, are you kidding me? You're telling me about earthly reward? This guy is defying God's army. He's defying the living God. And you're worried about an earthly reward. You know, David saw that it was God's army, and he saw the spiritual ramifications. And he realized what was at stake here was God's reputation and the spirit of God's people. The reproach that was all over Israel, it wasn't Goliath. The reproach for all of Israel was the fact that out of 200,000 men, there wasn't one who trusted God enough to stand up. Because God, look, we read it back in Joshua chapter 1. He's looking for one person who will be strong and of good courage. The eyes of the Lord go to and fro throughout the whole earth to show himself strong on someone's behalf. I mean, that's what he's looking for, is one person to trust him and step out. And David is being offered, first he's seen the circumstances, have you seen the man? And then he's offered earthly reward to do what is right and what the Spirit says he should be doing, which is trusting in God. And he's incensed. And the people answered him after this manner, saying, so shall it be done to the man that kills him. And that's what they have to offer. And Eliab, here's his second challenge. Eliab, his eldest brother, heard when he spake unto the men. And Eliab's anger was kindled against David. Any of you have brothers and sisters, you know how this works. David shows up at the battle, and he hears this. Now, Eliab and the other two brothers have been at the battle for 40 days, and they've heard this 40 days, and they've been scared for 40 days. And then little Dave, the sheep boy, who we don't know how old he is, 15 maybe, 16, 14, 13, we don't know. He's a young guy. He shows up on the scene, and he's like, are you kidding me? This big whatever is defaming the God of Israel? And the older brother doesn't take kindly to be shown up by the younger brother. And so when he hears it, when he spake unto the men, and Eliab's anger was kindled against David, and he said, why camest thou down hither? And with whom hast thou left those few sheep in the wilderness? Don't you have some sheep to be watching, boy? I know thy pride and the naughtiness of thine heart, for thou art come down that thou mightest see the battle. You are just looking to see some blood. That's why you're here, Dave. You naughty little boy. Did you even tell Dad? Does Dad know you're gone? And where's the sheep? And you're just down here to see a fight, you little punk. And you can see David's response. David said, what have I done now? Is there not a cause? What have I done now? I mean, come on, I just come down here. I hear all this stuff, and you're giving me a hard time. And his second really big problem is his critical family. his family looks at him and says, you got to be kidding me. I mean, it wasn't like when Samuel came to pick the next king and he walked in the front door, everybody knew it was going to be David out of the other brothers. They didn't even bother to call David because they figured there was no way it could be David. It must be the oldest or the next oldest. They didn't even call for him after all seven were rejected. And Samuel says, don't you have any more? I guess it's Dave, you know, but it's just the sheep guy. I mean, and that's, they didn't see him as anything else. And the Lord's Spirit came upon him when he was anointed. And yet still, it wasn't like everybody looked at David and said, oh yeah, that's a giant killer right there. He's a little kid. He's a young guy. And his brethren reject him. Now, when we look in the Gospels, in Mark chapter 6, Jesus is in his own home country. And he says in verse 4, Jesus said unto them, a prophet is not without honor but in his own country and among his own kin and in his own house. And he could do there no mighty work, save that he laid his hands upon a few sick folk and healed them. And he marveled because of their unbelief. And he went around the villages teaching. Of all the places he went, he couldn't do much in his own home ground because the people didn't believe. Now, I don't think that meant that, you know, Jesus went in there, but I'm sorry, I'd like to heal you, I tried, but you just don't have enough faith to be healed. I think what it means is Jesus went into town and, oh, Jesus is here. And everybody says, Jesus, what, you mean Joseph and Mary, Jude and James and whatever's brother? Go see him. I've seen him all my life. I don't need to go see him. And nobody sick came out. A few that he got his hands on, he healed. But by and large, they didn't believe that he was able to do anything because they knew him too well. They didn't recognize him for who he was. And the same thing happens under David. His family's critical. Everybody looks at him and thinks they know his heart when they don't. And David said, what have I now done? Is there not a cause? You know, he is a man after God's own heart, we're told. And I think the reason why, you have to understand, is because David spent night after night after night alone with God and the sheep underneath the stars, looking at the awesomeness of creation, looking at the intricacy of the heavens, looking at the way nature is designed, looking at the way the animals work together. And he had a respect, he had an awe for God from a personal relationship. And so when he comes out and he sees what's going on, he's like, are you kidding me? You guys, we're the nation of Israel. We serve the living God, and you guys are letting a big man talk trash about our army? Are you kidding me? Are you kidding me? He was a man after God's own heart. And look what he does in verse 30, which is probably what we should do when we encounter the same thing. Because look, you can get saved, especially those of you who got saved and the rest of your family isn't saved, and they look at you and like, yeah, we've always known you. Yeah, you're whatever. You're wacko. You're off on whatever religious trip you are. No, if your family rejects you, if they're looking at you from the natural, do what David does. It says he turned from him toward another. He didn't defend himself. He didn't say, I am too. I can do this. He just, yeah, whatever. You know, you want to talk, talk. I'm not going to listen to it. And he turned toward another and spake after the same manners. And it wasn't like David was talking trash about what I could do to Goliath. He was just saying, are you kidding me? I think he was really encouraging the troops. We're the army of the living God. What's up with this? Any of us could get out there and take this guy. That's what he's doing. And the people answered him again after the former manner. And when the words were heard which David spoke, they rehearsed them before Saul, and he sent for him. And David said to Saul, let no man's heart fail because of him. Thy servant will go and fight with this Philistine. You know, I like this thing about David, because David was anointed as the next king. The problem with being the next king is the current king is still alive, and you don't get to be the next king until the current king is out of the way. And so you would think David, knowing that he's destined to be the next king, is just looking for Saul to get out of the way so he can get to the throne. But that's not where he is. When Saul took him in and became one of his armor bearers and was playing music for him, it said David loved him. And he respected, he loved Saul. And look at him submit to Saul. He comes in and Saul is blowing it. As the king of Israel, if there's anybody who should be leading the troops, it should be the tallest guy in the camp, should be out there being faithful and showing faith towards God. And yet even in that, when this guy's blowing it, here's David submitting to him, and he says, don't let anybody's hearts fail. Your servant will go and fight with a Philistine. And again, we just read that verse in Mark chapter 6 where it says Jesus marveled because of their unbelief. There's only two places in the scripture where it says that Jesus marveled. One was at the unbelief of his countrymen. The other one was when he ran into that Gentile centurion when he was going on his way to his house to heal his servant, and the centurion sent somebody out and said, yeah, my master isn't worthy to have Jesus show up at our door. Just say the word and he'll be healed. And Jesus, it says he marveled and said to everybody around him, I haven't seen such great faith. And it was through that submission that he marveled. And here's David a man after God's own heart, exhibiting that to a king who doesn't deserve it by far. And Saul said to David, here's his third challenge. Saul the king says to David, you are not able to go against this Philistine to fight with him, for you are but a youth, and he a man of war from his youth. You're not qualified. And from a worldly perspective, he absolutely was right. David was not qualified to fight a giant. Nobody's qualified to fight a giant. This guy is bigger than anybody. Nobody is qualified. But again, God doesn't look upon the outside. He looks upon the heart. And from an earthly perspective, he's not. But from God's perspective, God uses the foolish things. He uses the weak things of the world. David's foolish. He's a sheep kid. And he's weak. He's a kid. So he's perfectly qualified. And when he's confronted with the idea, well, you're not qualified, he gives his qualifications. David said unto Saul, thy servant kept his father's sheep, and there came a lion and a bear, and took a lamb out of the flock. And I went out after him, and smote him, and delivered it out of his mouth. And when he rose against me, I caught him by his beard, and smote him, and slew him. How do you do that? I mean, you ever been to the zoo? I've been to the Philadelphia Zoo, and I remember being on the other side of the Philadelphia Zoo, first time I was in there, and I heard this, it was kind of like thunder, really, but it wasn't thunder, and you're like, what is that? And you come around to the other side, and there is the lion's den, and there's one big old main lion, two or three lionesses, a big moat, and then a fence with spikes on it that's real long, because, you know, so that supposedly he can't jump over it, although he had, I mean, if you've ever seen the lion, the lion knows he's tough. The lion knows he's cool. And he knows he is the king. I mean, you look at a lion and just, oh, they're just so prideful. They just stretch. Their muscles, I mean, they're just cut with a razor. And he had that look about him like, I can jump over that moat and eat you anytime I want. There is nothing you can do about it. And to think about a lion that weighs hundreds and hundreds of pounds, I mean, I've had a cat do damage on me. You ever try to take a cat somewhere that doesn't want to go? Just a cat, a house cat that weighs a pound and a half can just shred you, and you will not, I mean, you can't. Think about a 500-pound house cat that really doesn't want to go. Well, David chases, one takes a lamb. If it was me, I'd be thinking, I got 99 more, you know, they'll probably have another one pretty soon. Dad won't even know. I mean, what's one? No, he goes after the thing, and the lion turns around to fight him, and he said he grabs it by the beard, and what do you have in your hand to deal with a lion? I mean, do you ever think about, he's a sling guy. We're going to see him, you know, Goliath with a sling. You don't sling a lion from right here. What else has he got, a stick? Yeah, I mean, is that what he's doing on the lion? I don't know what he does, but he manages to. I want firepower. I want to be pulling my .454 Casull out, and, you know, I want something that's going to really kick. And he does it, I guess, with a stick. And he's not bragging. He's just saying, well, you know, I was, don't worry about it. I was out watching the sheep, and I had a, in fact, it says he had, and there came a lion and a bear and took a lamb out of the flock. Did they come together? It almost sounds like there was like a gang, you know, the mean animals gang. The lion and the bear show up together, and one of them's a lookout, and the other one, you know, takes the lamb. And I went out after him. I smote him, delivered it out of his mouth. And when he rose against me, I caught him by his beard and smote him and slew him. Thy servant slew both the lion and the bear. And this uncircumcised Philistine shall be as one of them, seeing he hath defied the armies of the living God. You know, David didn't know a whole lot. He knew how to be a shepherd. He'd never fought a giant before. He did know one thing. Well, he knew a couple things. One, he knew God. He knew God was awesome. He knew God had his hand on his life. In fact, he had met the prophet of God and had the oil dumped on his head. And he heard Samuel, who was a man of God, say, you're going to be the next king of Israel. So at this point, David has got to be thinking, I'm bulletproof. I mean, it's either right or, you know, I've got a promise from God. I am going to be the next king of Israel, which means I'm going to be the next king of Israel. So whatever I go out there and do in the middle of this field, I'm going to be the next king of Israel. So he's got a promise of God. I'm going to go out there. You don't have to worry about it. I am going to take this guy out because he has defied God. God is on my side. God is on our side. All I have to do is stand up. God will do the fighting. And the cool thing is, when you look at it from our perspective, we have the same promise, or we have a promise. Philippians 1:6, being confident of this very thing, that he which has begun a good work in you will perform it until the day of Jesus Christ. So David says, hey, I'm going. He's defied God. I'm going to win. And David said, moreover, the Lord that delivered me out of the paw of the lion and the paw of the bear, he will deliver me out of the hand of this Philistine. And he was convincing because it says, "And Saul said unto David, Go, and the Lord be with thee." And here we go. Here's the fourth thing that David has to deal with. After he gets the agreement to go, Saul armed David with his armor. And he put on a helmet of brass upon his head, and he armed him with a coat of mail. And David girded his sword upon his armor, and he essayed to go, for he had not proved it. David's a kid. Saul's the tallest guy in all of Israel. So he's got armor, 7 feet tall, got a kid getting 7 foot tall armor. Not only that, but he's got a sword. We read earlier on when they fought the Philistines, there was only two swords in Israel, Jonathan and Saul. The Philistines had all the weapons. So David's not a sword guy. He's a stick and a rock guy. That's what David knows. And now Saul says to him, well, okay, you're going to go. Let me tell you how it's done. What you need. This is the equipment. This is how you go out and do this thing. This is how you fight on the Lord's behalf. Well, Saul, if you knew how to do this, how come you're not out in the middle of the field? You know, but you're not on the field. You're telling me how to do it. You don't know. You won't do it yourself. You don't have the guts. But when somebody shows up and says, yeah, the Lord's telling me I can do it, well, let me tell you, this is how it's done. And he tries to equip him in the flesh. And it's just like the same thing that, you know, Paul said to the Galatians, this one thing would I learn of you, received you the Spirit by the works of the law or by the hearing of faith. Are you so foolish, having begun in the Spirit, are you now made perfect by the flesh? He said, look, it's the Spirit of God that's delivered you so far. Why would you all of a sudden feel like you need to use man's wisdom and man's defenses and man's programs? And David says, I haven't proved this stuff. I don't fight with this. This isn't my stuff. I can't do this. My armor is God. My weapon is God. I can't do this stuff. And David put them off of him, which is what we need to do when we face our giants, is go armed in the Lord and not worry so much about man's wisdom. And he took his staff in his hand, and he chose him 5 smooth stones out of the brook and put them in a shepherd's bag, which he had, even in a scrip. And his sling was in his hand, and he drew near to the Philistine. Now, the cool thing is, David walks down there, and he's got a sling, and he's got his little staff. He doesn't even get any rocks until he gets down into the middle of the brook. So he's pretty much committed before he even has a weapon. I mean, David is not really thinking, okay, these rocks are going to do it. He grabs 5. A lot of the commentators make a point of saying that Goliath has 4 brothers, and they're saying, well, David's arming himself, so he 1 rock for each brother. You know, I'll take out 5 giants. I don't know, maybe. Tough to say. I do know this. 5 stones are 100. He's got a bag full of rocks, you know. And yeah, you can, when they sling a stone, it's got some velocity. But when they walk out on the battlefield, this is not a fair fight. This is like, you know, taking my 9-year-old son and throwing him into the UFC to fight the heavyweight champ. I mean, this is, the word for this in other cultures is murder. That's what this is. I mean, this is a slaughter. This isn't a fight. This is him getting decimated. There's no way he can possibly win, according to the world standards anyways. And he drew near to the Philistine. And the Philistine came on and drew near unto David. And the man that bare the shield went before him. And when the Philistine looked about, and I'm sure he's looking like this before he sees the kid, and he saw David, he disdained him, for he was but a youth and ruddy and of a fair countenance. Goliath's ugly, okay? First of all, he's challenging, do you even have a man that can fight me? No, they send me a little boy. I mean, talk about disrespect. I mean, here he is talking trash, and they trot out a kid. I mean, he's a little pretty boy. He doesn't even look like a, you know, jacked up little kid. He's just a little boy. And Goliath's like, you gotta be kidding me. I'm a man of, you know, armor. And this guy comes out with a little kid. He disdained him, for he was but a youth and ruddy and a fair countenance. And the Philistine said unto David, am I a dog that thou comest to me with staves? And the Philistine cursed David by his guts. Because David's got a stick. Are you kidding me? You use a stick on a dog. I'm not a dog. I'm a, you know, I got swords. And I go, listen, you come out with a stick. And he curses him. And he's basically saying, do you know how outgunned you are right now? You're a little boy and you got a stick. I'm not a dog, boy. I'm a man. I'm a fight man. I'm a giant. I got weapons. You are completely outmanned. You're completely outarmed. And the Philistine said to David, come to me, and I will give thy flesh unto the fowls of the air, unto the beasts of the field. Come to me, and you're going to be roadkill, basically. Because whenever they had a battle, the birds would come out and pick the dead bodies and the animals. And, you know, I'm gonna tear you up and leave you in the field. Then said David to the Philistine, And you got to get the feeling of this here. The Philistine is saying, all you got's a stick? Boy, my sword is twice as tall as you. You got my staff weighs more than my spear weighs more than you do. My armor bearer is tougher than you. Are you kidding me? That's all you got? You know how armed you are? And David returns and he says, all you come out here with is a sword and a spear? That's all you got? I come to you in the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have defied. I've got a thermonuclear weapon. You don't understand what is going to happen here. You obviously don't know about superior firepower. If that little shiny metal thing you got is all you got, you have no idea because you've annoyed God and now you're going to fight him. He says, this day, not only Philistine says, I'm going to beat you. And David says, no, you don't understand. You're outgunned, and I'm not just going to beat you. Look what he says. This day will the Lord deliver thee into mine hand, and I'll smite thee, and take thine head from off thee, and I will give the carcasses of the host of the Philistines this day unto the fowls of the air, and unto the wild beasts of the earth, and all the earth may know that there is a God in Israel. No. You're not going to lose. You're all going to lose. I'm not just beating you. I'm going to beat the whole army, and I'll be taking all of your bodies and letting the birds pick them. This is not going to be a little fight. This is going to be a big fight. And, I mean, David, he didn't have anything sharp. He had a stick. You know, how are you going to cut a head off with a stick? It doesn't work that way. No, David knew what he was going to do, or he had a pretty good idea. And all this assembly shall know. And that's the point. David, and David's pointing around, he's not talking about the Philistines because they're all going to be dead. No, he's saying all this assembly, all of these men of Israel, they'll know that the Lord saves not with a sword and a spear, for the battle is the Lord's, and he will give you into our hands. This is David becoming a king in the eyes of the army, because they've been following a man who is a tall man, who is a scared man, and can do nothing but offer some carnal goods to try to entice people to act spiritual. And David says, no, let me show you what is going to be done. And when this is all said and done, you're going to be dead, they're all going to be dead, and these guys are going to know that we serve the living God. That's what's at stake. And it came to pass when the Philistine arose and came and drew nigh to meet David. This is incredible. That David hasted and ran toward the army to meet the Philistine. Goliath starts to make a move towards David, and I'm sure he sees something that he probably hasn't seen in a very long time, which is someone actually anxious to fight him. David does not, any of you guys ever watch fighting? I like to watch some of the UFC stuff, the full contact martial arts fighting. A lot of times when there are two guys who are really evenly matched, it'll be like the first round before they hardly even take a punch because they're so afraid the other guy's going to make a move that they're just kind of circling and sparring. David is not that guy. When you really believe you're going to destroy your enemy, you don't wait. And David just full out run towards Goliath. I mean, out comes a stone and he starts whipping it. And Goliath's got to be thinking, they've sent me a retarded boy. I'm really feeling bad. I'm going to have to beat this poor boy who doesn't know any better. There's no sense in Israel. They send out this poor delusional kid and he must think he's Superboy or something. I don't know, but if that's what it's going to take. And so, they start moving towards each other. David put his hand in his bag, and he took thence a stone and slang it. He slang it and smote the Philistine in his forehead, that the stone sunk into his forehead, and he fell upon his face to the earth. So they're running at each other. Out comes a sling. And David, I don't know if you've ever tried to use a sling. I've tried the slingshot. This is the two pieces of, the long string of leather with a patch in the middle, and you put a rock in there, and you swing it, and you let go of one end, and it flies. Don't know how you're that accurate with it anyways, but this is a moving target with a helmet of brass. But the truth is, David was going to win because God was on his side. David could have come out and taken that stone and gone, foo, and just thrown it into the air because God was like, shoof, and that thing was, it was a homing rock at this point. This was a laser-guided rock, and his face was painted with a little red dot, and it was going to hit right where it was going to hit. All David had to do was step into the field. And God is listening for 40 days as his people cower before this giant, and he's just waiting for David to get on the scene and say, are you kidding me? Is there not a man out here who believes in God? And he goes out in there, and God's like, yes. Bring it. Yes. That's what it is. And so David hucks the stone, hits him, and it's quiet. Because everybody in Israel's going, Their mouths are all, you know, dropped, and everybody in the Philistines are like, you know, and they're thinking, okay, he's faking it. You know, he's just faking it to play with his kid. All the Israelites are thinking, David, don't get too close. You know, he's going to get up now, you know, and yet down he goes. And David prevailed over the Philistine with a sling and with a stone and smote the Philistine and slew him. But there was no sword in the hand of David. Therefore, David ran and stood upon the Philistine and took his sword and drew it out of the sheath thereof and slew him and cut off his head therewith. How did he even lift the sword? I mean, it's got to be one of those things where it's, you know, when he cuts off his head. And the men of Israel and of Judah arose and shouted and pursued the Philistines until thou come to the valley, to the gates of Ekron. And the wounded of the Philistines fell down by the way of Shaarim, even to Gath and unto Ekron. And notice what happens. And this is what happens in life. It seems like I keep coming across this over and over again as we go through the Old Testament. One person stands up, completely unqualified, trusts in God radically, says, I'm going to believe you. I have faith that you'll have the victory, and stands. And everybody else around him sees it, and they get motivated to follow. Just like everybody said with Joshua, be strong and of good courage, and we will follow you. That's all we ask. The people see David showing courage, and they follow him, and they put to flight the Philistines. They have a great victory. And the children of Israel returned from chasing after the Philistines, and they spoiled their tents. They took all their stuff. And David took the head of the Philistine and brought it to Jerusalem. But he put his armor in his tent. You know, David, back home, he's got that lion he killed mounted, and he's got the bear mounted, and now he's going to have Goliath. Probably cut off his hands, you know, to hold him out, to hold the sword. I mean, now he brings back the head because he killed the giant. You know, David's going, I killed the giant, man. I mean, he's still blown. He's got to be. Because anytime, I know this, and anytime that God has ever worked through me to do something that I thought was impossible, afterwards you're always like, get out of here. No way. I mean, anything like that. When God works through you and does something that's beyond you, you just want to like live there. And David wants to live there. And he, you know, look, the scripture tells us to remember the rock from which we were hewn, the pit from which we were dug. This is a trophy of the work of God. And David is not putting it down. He wants everybody to know about the faithfulness of God. And he's carrying that thing around. He took the head of the Philistine and he brought it to Jerusalem. And when Saul saw David go forth against the Philistine, he said to Abner, the captain of the host, Abner, whose son is this youth? And Abner said, as thy soul liveth, O king, I cannot tell. And the king said, inquire thou whose son the stripling is. And look, David returned from the slaughter of the Philistines. Abner took him and brought him before Saul with the head of the Philistine in his hand. I mean, how big was that head? It had to be nasty, gross, you know, big old honking. But David is not putting that head down. He's running around, he's chasing the Philistines, going, you know, with that head. He's carrying it everywhere, and he brings it in before Saul. And Saul said unto him, whose son art thou, thou young man? And David answered, I am the son of thy servant Jesse, the Bethlehemite. Now, it wasn't that Saul didn't know who he was, but he apparently had been one of his courtiers. And we're going to see as we get into the next chapter that he's going to be permanently invited to stay at the court. And you know, part of the reward was that your family will be tax-free. Perhaps Saul was looking to see, you know, which family gets the tax-free reward. But let me encourage you with this. David was completely unqualified. The only thing that he had that qualified him is that he trusted in God and he knew how awesome God was. And that is all God is looking for, is somebody who will radically step out and trust him and actually run at the giants that they face. Not sit back to the last possible second and try to do it in your own strength until you can't anymore. That's what Saul and the army was doing. They were still trying to figure an angle. Saul, you know, somewhere in those 40 days, he comes up with the reward idea, and then he throws his daughter into the deal, and then the tax-free thing, he keeps adding to it. He's trying to come up with an angle to do this thing, and it's impossible until God comes on the scene. And if you are struggling with some giant in your life, and you've been trying to find an angle, how about you just trust God and you throw caution to the wind and run full head first into your giant. See what God will do. He is faithful and he still keeps his promises. Let's pray. Lord, thank you so much that you are a God who uses the foolish things, who uses the weak, who uses the young boy. Lord, I pray that we would be that young boy, that young girl, Lord, that you can use, who doesn't know a lot and have a lot, but who trusts you and who knows you. Lord, give us that relationship that would cause us to run headfirst at our giants. And Lord, I pray you would pour your spirit out in our lives, Lord, that other people would see us believing you, acting, Lord, in faith after your word, and would be encouraged, Lord, to believe and to trust and to fight. Please give us victory, we ask in Jesus' name.